She had nothing left, no home, no name, no one in that candlelit room who believed a poor woman's mind was worth a single moment of their time. And then the most powerful man in the county opened his mouth in Latin, certain she would never understand a word. He was wrong. What happened next silenced every voice in Whitcomb Hall and changed both their lives forever. If this is your first time here, subscribe and come along and drop your city in the comments below so I can see just how far this story has traveled. The summer of 1816 sat heavy over Whitcomb County, Virginia, the way summers do when the heat has nowhere to go, and neither do the people trapped beneath it. The air smelled of cut hay and horse sweat and something else, something older, harder, the particular smell of a room full of wealthy people performing their goodness at one another, like actors who have forgotten the audience already knows the play. Abigail Mercer had been standing near the east wall of the Whitcomb parlor for 1 hour and 40 minutes. She knew because she had counted the quarter strikes of the grandfather clock behind her, the way a person counts things when they are not allowed to speak, sit, move freely, or be treated as though they belong to the same species as the people being served. She was 26 years old. She was wearing the same gray dress she had worn the 3 summers before that. It had been let out at the seams twice and pressed so many times the fabric had gone thin at the elbows. She carried a small stack of letters for Mrs. Bellamy, the widow who employed her, and she held them the way she held everything given to her by wealthy people, carefully, correctly, without complaint. Nobody in that room looked at her. That was not an accident. That was a system. Abigail understood systems. Her father had taught her that. Reverend Thomas Mercer had been a traveling scholar and a preacher, and a man who believed with the particular stubbornness of the genuinely good that a girl's mind was no smaller than a boy's, simply because the world had decided to treat it that way. He had taught Abigail Latin before she was 10, French before she was 12, legal commentary, scripture, arithmetic, land law, and the history of nations that had risen and fallen because powerful men had confused cruelty for intelligence. Then he died. And Abigail inherited nothing but the knowledge itself, which, as she had quickly learned, a poor woman in Virginia in the year 1816 could not spend, could not present in a court of law, and could not use to stop a creditor named Harlan Voss from arriving at her door 6 weeks after the funeral with a debt paper she had never seen before and a sheriff who did not care to look at it very carefully. She lost the house in March. She found the position with Mrs. Bellamy in April. She arrived at Whitcomb Hall in June, carrying one trunk and the expression of a woman who had learned that the safest place for her real self was somewhere no one thought to look. The party was in full motion around her. Candles burned in the tall iron stands. Crystal caught the light and scattered it across the plaster ceiling. Men in their best Federal-era coats stood in clusters speaking about tobacco prices, land disputes, the behavior of Congress, and the moral failures of people they would never meet. Women in silk and muslin drifted between them, performing the particular art of being present without taking up space. Mrs. Bellamy, a broad woman with a sharp eye and a sharper opinion about everything, sat near the fireplace with her niece Clara at her elbow. Clara Bellamy was 19, and lovely, and miserable, in the precise way that young women are miserable when they are ornamental by birth and intelligent enough to know it. She kept her eyes low and her hands folded, and she smiled when she was looked at and stopped the moment the gaze moved on. The man everyone in the room was performing for stood at the center of it all. Nathaniel Whitcomb was 35 years old, and he was the kind of man who makes a room rearrange itself without asking. He was tall, lean, dark-coated, and carried himself with the controlled stillness of a man who had long ago decided that showing emotion was a form of debt he was not willing to accrue. He had been a lawyer in Richmond before his father's death left him the plantation and the county weight that came with it. People said he was brilliant. People also said he was cold. They said both things with the same admiring tone which told Abigail everything she needed to know about what Whitcomb County valued in a man. She watched him from the wall, not with longing, not with resentment, with the same careful attention she gave to everything, reading a situation the way her father had taught her to read a contract, looking for the clause that would eventually cause the trouble. The trouble that evening came from a conversation about education. It started simply enough. One of the planters, a red-faced man named Holt, whose tobacco fields ran 3 miles south, made some remark about the new schoolhouse proposal for the county, and whether it was wise to extend reading instruction to all children, or whether that was the kind of thing that caused social disorder. The room, as rooms do, bent toward the richest voice, and the richest voice was Nathaniel Whitcomb's, Education Without Station. Nathaniel said swirling the wine in his glass is like a lantern given to a man who is walking into a wall. The light does not change the direction. It only lets him see the wall more clearly. Several men laughed. A few women smiled with the careful neutrality of people who had opinions and had learned not to share them. Abigail did not react. She had heard this argument before. She had heard it from judges and creditors and county clerks. She had heard it from the man who had taken her house. Then Nathaniel's gaze moved. It moved the way powerful men's gazes often move at parties, casually, almost accidentally, taking inventory of the room with the mild disinterest of someone who owns everything in it. It landed on Abigail. She felt it land. She did not look away. That would have looked like guilt. She simply stood still, holding the letters the way a woman stands when she has been standing still for a very long time and has learned to make her body take up no more space than the furniture. Nathaniel looked at the letters, looked at her gray dress, looked at her face, which gave him nothing. Then he turned back to the men around him with the faint expression of a man who has just confirmed a suspicion. He spoke in Latin. He spoke it clearly, conversationally, loud enough for the 3 or 4 educated men in his immediate circle to hear, and with the particular ease of a man performing for an audience, he is certain will appreciate the joke. Quaedam feminae libros ferunt ut mendici ferunt argentea pocula ad speciem non usum. Some women carry books the way beggars carry silver cups for appearance not use. The men who understood it laughed. Softly, the way educated men laugh when they are being cruel in a language they assume others cannot follow, as though the Latin itself makes the cruelty elegant. Clara Bellamy looked quickly at Abigail. Abigail did not move. Her fingers tightened on the letters. Just once. Just enough that she felt the paper bend slightly under the pressure. Then she loosened them deliberately, the way she loosened every response she was not yet ready to give slowly with full intention. The room had already moved on. Nathaniel had already turned back to his conversation. He was making another remark about land reform, his voice returning to its usual measured cadence, and the men around him were nodding in the way men nod when they want to be seen agreeing with the most powerful person available. Abigail looked at the grandfather clock. She looked at Mrs. Bellamy, who had not heard the Latin and would not have cared if she had. She looked at Clara, who had heard it, whose eyes were bright with something that was not quite anger and not quite grief, but lived in the narrow country between them. And then Abigail lifted her head. She did not raise her voice. She did not make a scene. She did not do any of the things that would have given the room permission to dismiss her. She simply spoke, in Latin, clearly, calmly, pitched at the exact same conversational volume Nathaniel had used, directed at no one in particular, and therefore at everyone. Calix argenteus aquam purum ferre potest domine. Sed calix aureus venenatus esse potest. A silver cup may still hold clean water, sir, but a golden one can be poisoned. The room did not go silent all at once. Silence like that moves in a wave. It starts with the people closest and spreads outward as each person registers what they have heard and turns to confirm it with the face of the person next to them. The wave took about 4 seconds. By the time it reached the far end of the parlor, Nathaniel Whitcomb had turned around. He was looking at her with an expression she would think about many times in the months that followed. Not anger, not embarrassment exactly, but something more unsettled than either. Like a man who has reached for a door he has opened 1,000 times and found it suddenly locked from the inside. Abigail did not stop. She shifted to French smooth, unhurried the French of a woman who had learned it before she was 12, from a father who believed she deserved every language the world had locked away from her. Vous avez confondu ma pauvreté avec mon ignorance, monsieur. Ce n'est pas de l'intelligence, c'est de la paresse habillée en jugement. You mistook my poverty for ignorance, sir. That is not intelligence. That is laziness dressed as judgment. Several of the women in the room understood French. She could see it in the way their expressions shifted, that involuntary flicker of recognition, that split second, before the social training kicked back in and smoothed everything flat. Then Abigail spoke in English. Plain, clear Virginia English, so that every person in the room, educated or not, wealthy or not, Latin-speaking or not, could follow every single word. I apologize for the interruption, Mrs. Bellamy. She turned to her employer with the composed expression of a woman delivering a report about the weather. Would you like me to place these letters on the writing table, or shall I hold them until after the guests have gone? The silence in the room had a texture to it now. It was not the polite silence of people being careful. It was the stunned silence of people who had just witnessed something they did not have a category for. Nathaniel had still not spoken. He was still looking at her. The wine glass was in his hand, and he had forgotten it was there. Clara Bellamy had pressed both hands over her mouth. Her eyes above her fingers were bright and enormous, and filled with an expression that in a different room in a different year might have been open laughter. Mrs. Bellamy said, "The writing table will do fine, Abigail." In the voice of a woman who had not quite caught everything that had just happened, but had caught enough to know she should proceed as though she had not. Abigail walked to the writing table. She set the letters down. She smoothed the top one with two fingers precisely the way she always did. Then she curtsied not to Nathaniel, not to the room, but to Mrs. Bellamy correctly and briefly, and she walked toward the door. She did not hurry. Hurrying would have suggested she was fleeing. She was not fleeing. She had said what she came to say, and she was leaving because she was finished. She crossed the parlor in 12 steps. She was counting. At the doorway she paused, not for effect, not because she had planned it, but because there was a small table just inside the door that someone had pushed into the path, and she needed to angle her body slightly to pass it. In that pause, she heard Nathaniel Whitcomb speak for the first time since she had answered him. He said nothing to her. He said it to the room. His voice was quieter than usual, and had something in it she would not name until much later. "Gentlemen," he said, "I believe we were discussing land reform." But nobody moved back into the conversation right away. They stood for a moment longer, looking at the empty doorway where Abigail had been, and then at Nathaniel, and then carefully, studiedly, at nothing at all. Abigail walked down the corridor alone. The heat of the summer night came through the tall windows on her left. Candles burned low in their iron holders along the wall. Her footsteps were quiet on the runner carpet. She kept her breathing even in through the nose slow, the way her father had taught her to breathe in difficult situations. He had called it the scholar's breath. Not because it required learning, because it required discipline. She did not shake until she reached the small servant's sitting room at the end of the hall. Then she sat down in the chair beside the cold fireplace, and she put her hands flat on her knees, and she breathed. Her hands were trembling. Not from fear, though there was fear in it. She was a woman without money, without property, without a single legal protection that could survive a wealthy man's displeasure. And she had just publicly corrected the most powerful man in Whitcomb County in front of every person whose opinion mattered to her continued employment. Fear was the rational response. She was not ashamed of it. But the trembling was not only fear. It was the particular trembling of a person who has been holding something very heavy for a very long time and has just briefly set it down. She thought about her father. She thought about the house in March. She thought about Harlan Voss and his debt paper, and the sheriff who had not looked at it carefully. She thought about the 11 months since her father's death, during which she had spoken her real mind to no one at all, had carried it quietly and visibly, the way beggars carry silver cups. She let herself tremble for exactly 4 minutes. Then she smoothed her dress, folded her hands, and began to think about what came next. What came next, she understood clearly, was probably dismissal. Mrs. Bellamy was a social creature, and a practical one. She would not want a companion who made scenes. The fact that it had been Nathaniel who made the scene first in Latin, in a language he had assumed Abigail could not understand, that would not matter. That was not how the accounting worked in rooms like that parlor. The woman who answered back would be the one remembered as difficult. She accepted this. She did not accept that it had been wrong to answer. There was a difference, and it was the difference her father had spent his life trying to explain to her, not with words, but with the patient fact of his own example. He had defended poor farmers in courtrooms full of men who had decided the outcome before the testimony. He had lost most of those cases. He had kept going anyway. The truth, he used to say, doesn't need you to win. It only needs you to say it. Abigail sat in the servant's chair in the hot Virginia summer night, listening to the muffled sounds of the party down the hall, and she said it again in her own mind quietly in all three languages. She was still sitting there when she heard footsteps in the corridor. Measured, deliberate footsteps. Not Mrs. Bellamy's quick shuffle. Not Clara's light step. Male. Heavy-booted. Controlled. They stopped outside the sitting room door. There was a pause. Then a single knock. Abigail looked at the door. She did not stand up immediately. She straightened her spine, smoothed the front of her dress, and then she stood. She crossed to the door and opened it. Nathaniel Whitcomb stood in the corridor. He had his coat on, still his wine glass no longer in his hand. He looked in the low candlelight of the hallway, like a man who had come somewhere he had not entirely decided to come, a man whose feet had made a decision his dignity was still catching up with. He looked at her for a moment, without speaking. She looked back at him with the expression she had spent the last 11 months perfecting, composed, correct, revealing nothing she was not prepared to lose. "Miss Mercer," he said finally. His voice was its usual controlled register, but there was something careful in it, careful in a way that was different from cold. "Mr. Whitcomb," she said, another pause. Down the corridor she could hear the party, the drift of conversation. Someone's laughter, the distant sound of a pianoforte beginning a reel. "I came," he said, "to tell you that you were correct in your assessment." She waited. "That was not," he said with the particular precision of a man selecting words the way you select where to step in uncertain terrain, "an intelligent remark on my part." "No," she agreed. "It was not." He blinked. She had the sense he had expected something, gratitude perhaps, or at least softening. The customary feminine performance of grace in the face of a powerful man's concession. She did not perform it. "I spoke out of habit," he said. "I know," she said. "That is what made it worse." His jaw tightened slightly. Not in anger, she was reading him carefully now, watching the small adjustments of his face the way her father had taught her to watch witnesses in a courtroom. It was not anger. It was something closer to recognition. The particular discomfort of a person who has been seen doing something they knew was wrong and had been doing it long enough to have stopped noticing. "You have studied law," he said. It was not a question. He had heard her reference to legal commentary from somewhere. Perhaps Clara had mentioned it, or perhaps he had simply noticed the way she had framed her reply in the parlor, the clean structural logic of it. Or perhaps he was simply the kind of man who paid attention when he finally started paying attention. "My father was a scholar," she said. "He taught me everything he knew." "And where is your father now?" "Dead," she said. 8 months ago." He was quiet for a moment. "I'm sorry," he said, and she believed him, which surprised her. "Thank you," she said. He looked at her for another moment, that same unsettled look she had seen in the parlor, the locked door expression, and then he gave a brief correct nod, the nod of a man who is going to retreat now before he says something he cannot take back. "Good evening, Miss Mercer," he said. "Good evening, Mr. Whitcomb." He turned and walked back down the corridor toward the party. She watched him go. His footsteps were still measured and controlled, but there was something in the set of his shoulders that had not been there when he arrived. She couldn't have named it precisely. She went back inside and closed the door quietly. She sat back down in the servant's chair. Outside, the Virginia summer pressed against the windows. Somewhere in the fields beyond the house, something called once in the dark and then went silent. Abigail put her hands flat on her knees again. They were not trembling anymore. She thought about the locked door look on Nathaniel Whitcomb's face. She thought about what it meant when a man like that came down a corridor. He did not have to come down to say words. He did not have to say to a woman whose dismissal would cost him nothing, and whose opinion could cost him something he had not yet fully calculated. She thought about what kind of man was underneath the cold that everyone admired and everyone feared. She thought about what her father used to say about armor. Any man who builds his walls high enough. He had said once, watching a defendant refuse to show grief in a courtroom where grief would have saved him, is a man who believes the walls are all that's keeping him standing. The saddest thing isn't the wall. It's that he's forgotten what was there before he built it. Abigail looked at the cold fireplace. She did not know yet what was going to happen in this house. She did not know about the morning she would spend in the library with the old legal commentary. She did not know about the conversations that would begin before sunrise and last past breakfast. She did not know about Eleanor Whitcomb arriving from Richmond, or the courtroom, or the choices that would be made in front of people who had already decided what they believed. She only knew what she had always known, that her mind was her own, that truth did not require permission to exist, and that somewhere inside the most powerful man in Whitcomb County, there was a locked door that someone had forgotten was a door. She did not know yet that she was the one who was going to knock, but she was starting to suspect it. And in the hot, still candlelit summer of 1816, in a servant's chair, in a house that did not belong to her, Abigail Mercer sat alone with everything she knew and everything she was, and for the first time in 8 months, she did not try to make herself smaller. She simply let herself be exactly the size she was. And that, as it turned out, was more than enough to change everything. The next morning came early, the way Virginia summers always did heat, arriving before the light pressing through the walls of Whitcomb Hall, like something that had been waiting outside all night for permission to enter. Abigail was already awake. She had slept perhaps 3 hours. Not from distress, she had made her peace with what happened in the parlor before she closed her eyes, but from the particular restlessness of a mind that had been quiet for too long and had finally been given something real to work on. She lay in the narrow servant's bed in the small room off the east corridor, and she thought the way her father had taught her to think methodically without panic, turning the facts over like stones to see what lived underneath. Fact, she had publicly corrected Nathaniel Whitcomb in front of every person in Whitcomb County whose opinion carried legal and social weight. Fact, she was a woman without property, without family, without a single document in her name that could survive a wealthy man's displeasure. Fact. Nathaniel had come down the corridor afterward. He had apologized, in his way, which was not nothing. Fact, she still had no idea what it meant. She dressed before 5. She took her father's old copy of Blackstone's Commentaries from the bottom of her trunk, the one book she had managed to keep through everything, the one thing Harlan Voss had not thought to take, because he had not thought a woman would value a law book, and she carried it down the back corridor toward the library. She had discovered the Whitcomb Library on her third day at the house, the way she discovered most things quietly, without making a production of it, simply by walking through a door that was not locked and finding what was inside. It was a substantial room for a Virginia plantation house. Floor-to-ceiling shelves on 3 walls, a wide oak table in the center, 2 leather chairs near the window that faced east, and therefore caught the first light of the morning before any other room in the house. She had come here every morning since before the household woke, before Mrs. Bellamy required anything before the social performance of the day began. She sat in the left-hand chair with her father's Blackstone, and she read for 1 hour, and she let herself be, for that 1 hour, exactly who she was. She did not expect anyone else to be there. She pushed the library door open and stopped. Nathaniel Whitcomb was already in the room. He was standing at the far shelves with his back to the door in shirt sleeves. No coat, no cravat. Just the plain linen shirt of a man who had come to his own library before he had finished dressing for the day. He had a book in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other, and he had clearly not heard her come in. Abigail stood very still in the doorway. She considered retreating. She could be back in the corridor in 3 steps, and he would never know she had been there. She could come back tomorrow. She could find another hour, another room, another place to be herself in private. She did not retreat. She was tired of retreating. She walked into the library and sat down in the left-hand chair and opened her Blackstone and began to read. Nathaniel turned around. He looked at her. She looked at the page. There was a silence that lasted long enough to have a shape. "Miss Mercer," he said. "Mr. Whitcomb," she said without looking up. Another pause. She heard him set the coffee cup down on the oak table. She heard him shift his weight. "This is my library," he said. "Yes," she said. "I know. You come here in the mornings." She looked up then. "You knew. Henderson told me." Henderson was the house steward, a quiet, careful man who noticed everything and said almost nothing. "He said you arrive before 5 and leave before 6:30. He said you are always reading when you come and always reading when you go." Abigail looked at him steadily. "I apologize if I overstepped." "I didn't say you overstepped," Nathaniel said. She waited. "I said Henderson told me." He pulled the chair on the right side of the table out and sat down. He set his book flat on the table between them. He looked at hers. "Blackstone," he said. "Commentaries on the Laws of England," she said. "Volume 2. Property Law." "Why property law?" She looked at him for a moment. It was a direct question, and he was looking at her with the expression of a man who was genuinely asking, not testing, not performing interest, but actually asking. She had been answering disingenuous questions for 11 months. She knew the difference. "Because a man named Harlan Voss produced a debt paper against my father's estate 6 weeks after my father died," she said. "The paper was dated 18 months before his death. It claimed my father had borrowed $400 against the value of our house. My father never borrowed $400 in his life. He distrusted debt on principle and kept his accounts in a ledger I have memorized completely. The paper was false. I knew it was false. And I could not prove it in any court in this county, because I am a woman, and I had no lawyer, and the sheriff had already decided." Nathaniel had not moved while she said this. He was watching her with the focused stillness of a man in a courtroom. She recognized that look because her father had described it to her. The look of a lawyer who has stopped formulating his next question and has started actually listening to the answer. "You lost the house," he said. "In March," she said. "Yes." "And you believe the document was forged?" "I don't believe it," she said. "I know it. I simply cannot prove it yet." The word "yet" sat in the air between them like a held breath. "What would proof look like?" he asked. Abigail turned to a page near the back of her Blackstone. She had been carrying the thought for 8 months, and it came out of her now with the clean precision of something that had been sharpened for a long time. "The paper claims my father signed it in September of 1814. It uses the phrasing, 'pursuant to the provisions herein established,' in reference to the county debt registry. That registry provision wasn't enacted until the spring of 1815. No one drafting a legitimate document in September of 1814 would use language that didn't exist yet." Nathaniel was very still. "I noticed it 3 weeks after I lost the house," Abigail said. "When I finally got a look at a copy of the original county registry records at the courthouse, the clerk let me see them because he thought I was picking up correspondence for Mrs. Bellamy." She paused. "I was not picking up correspondence for Mrs. Bellamy." Something moved across Nathaniel's face. It was not quite a smile. It was something more complicated than that, something that started as surprise and passed through something else on its way to a place she could not name. "That is," he said carefully, "a significant legal observation." "Yes," she said. "It is."
"And you've told no one?"
"I've told you," she said. "Just now." He looked at her for a long moment. Then he picked up his coffee and drank and set it down again, and she had the sense he was using the gesture the way she used her counting to give himself a moment to think before he spoke.
"Voss," he said. "Harlan Voss."
"You know him."
"I know of him."
His voice had shifted slightly, not colder exactly, but more precise. The lawyer's register, she thought. "He has been involved in 3 land disputes in this county in the past 4 years. He has won all 3. The men he worked with in 2 of those cases have interests in common with several families in this county." He stopped.
"Old interests, old arrangements."
Abigail watched him. "Arrangements that would make it inconvenient to expose him.
Arrangements."
Nathaniel said,
That would make it actively dangerous to try. The word dangerous hung between them.
For whom? Abigail asked.
For anyone without sufficient standing to absorb the retaliation, he said. And then, more quietly, with something that sounded almost like honesty, and for anyone with sufficient standing who chose to use it. Abigail did not look away from him.
Is that a warning, Mr. Whitcomb?
I don't know yet, he said. And for the first time, she believed he was telling her the truth about his own uncertainty rather than performing certainty he did not feel. They sat in silence for a moment. Outside, the first birds of the morning started up in the trees beyond the window.
Your father, Nathaniel said. He defended farmers in land disputes.
Yes.
And lost most of them.
Yes.
And kept going.
Yes.
He looked at the book in front of her. He looked at his own hands on the table. Then he looked at her face with the locked door expression she had seen the night before, and this time she understood it slightly better.
It was not a man who had forgotten the door was there. It was a man who had spent so long deciding not to open it that he had begun to mistake the decision for architecture.
He sounds, Nathaniel said, like either a very principled man or a very stubborn one.
In my experience, Abigail said, those are the same thing.
That was when the almost smile returned. Briefly. Gone before she could be certain she had seen it.
He stood up, picked up his book, and walked back toward the shelves. He stood there for a moment with his back to her, his hand on the spine of a volume she couldn't read from where she sat.
Miss Mercer, he said without turning around.
Yes.
Come back tomorrow morning.
A pause.
If you'd like.
She looked at the back of his head, at the set of his shoulders, slightly less rigid than they had been when she walked in.
I come every morning, she said.
Yes, he said. I know.
He took his book from the shelf and walked out of the library without looking back. Abigail sat alone in the left-hand chair for a long moment. Then she turned back to her Blackstone, smoothed the page, and kept reading. She came back the next morning, and the morning after that.
It started as parallel silence. Two people in the same room reading different books, not speaking. The only sounds the occasional turn of a page. The settling of the house around them. The birds outside getting louder as the summer mornings lengthened. It was a comfortable silence. Abigail had not expected that. She had expected it to be loaded, careful performance, the particular performance of two people from different stations pretending to be at ease. But it wasn't. It was simply quiet. It felt in a way she was careful not to trust too quickly, like the morning hours in her father's study when she was young. The conversation came gradually. He asked her about Blackstone, and she answered specifically citing passages, and then asked him directly without softening the directness. What he thought was the greatest single failure of English property law as applied to women in the American context. He looked at her for a moment as though recalibrating some expectation he had not realized he was holding. Then he answered, specifically, without condescension. They argued about land tenure for 40 minutes one morning. She won the argument and he told her she had won it, which surprised her more than the argument itself. Another morning, she brought the county registry notes she had been keeping in the back of a blank ledger she had purchased with a week's wages. Small, careful, precise records of the language shifts in public documents going back 12 years, tracking the exact moment certain legal phrasings had entered the county's official vocabulary. He looked at her notes for a long time without speaking. Then he said very quietly, "This is the work of a lawyer, Miss Mercer."
"My father's work," she said.
"No," he said.
"Yours."
Clara Bellamy noticed.
Of course she did.
Clara was 19 and miserable and observant in the precise way that intelligent people are observant when they have nothing to do with their intelligence but watch. She caught Abigail coming back from the library one morning later than usual, the conversation having run past its hour, and she fell into step beside her in the corridor with the slightly too casual air of someone who has been waiting.
"You were in the library again," Clara said.
"I was," Abigail said.
"With him."
Abigail looked at her.
"We were both in the library, yes."
Clara was quiet for a few steps. Then she said in a different voice, younger, less composed, the voice underneath the performance, "Is he different with you?" Abigail thought about it honestly. "He is less certain that silence is the same as safety," she said. "I think that is different for him." Clara stopped walking. She turned to face Abigail with an expression that was several things at once: worry, something like envy, and something that was not envy at all, but looked like it from a distance. "Abigail," she said, "my aunt intends for me to marry him." "I know," Abigail said. "And you know I don't want to." "I know. And you know that my wanting or not wanting has no standing in this house, or in this county, or in any arrangement my aunt and his family have decided to make." "I know that too," Abigail said quietly. Clara looked at her for a moment. Then she said very quietly, "I'm not warning you away from him. I want you to understand that. I am not jealous of the library, or the conversations, or whatever it is that is happening in there in the mornings." She took a breath. "I am telling you because I think you should know what you are walking into. And I am telling you because I think you are the only person in this house who might actually know what to do with the information." Abigail looked at the younger woman carefully. "What are you afraid of, Clara?" "My aunt will notice," Clara said. "And when she does," she stopped. Started again. "Mrs. Eleanor Whitcomb is coming from Richmond at the end of the month. She has a very clear idea of what her son should be and who he should marry and what role the women in this household are permitted to occupy." A pause. "I have been in that role for 2 years. I know exactly what she does to women who step outside it." The corridor was empty around them. Somewhere in the house, Mrs. Bellamy was calling for her morning tea. "Thank you," Abigail said, simply, directly, without performance. Clara nodded once. Then she straightened the posture, returning the expression smoothing, and went to answer her aunt's call. Abigail stood alone in the corridor for a moment. Eleanor Whitcomb. End of the month. She filed the information carefully and walked back to her duties. The days continued. The morning conversations deepened in ways that were harder to categorize. They spoke about justice not as an abstraction, but as a mechanical question. What does a just system actually require in order to function, and what is lost when the people administering it confuse convenience for principle? Nathaniel had opinions, strong ones. He expressed them with the contained precision of a man who had been a lawyer long enough to know how to build an argument, but there was something underneath the precision that she started to identify after about the fifth morning of frustration. Old. Settled. The frustration of a man who had known what was right in a courtroom, had chosen what was safe instead, and had been paying the internal cost of that choice for years without admitting what it was. She did not say this to him directly. Not yet. But she was thinking it. One morning he asked her why she had not tried to find a lawyer herself, to contest the Voss document through proper channels. "I tried," she said. "Three lawyers in the county, two in Richmond. And the first told me he could not take the case without a retainer I could not pay. The second told me that without a male guardian to bring the claim, I had no legal standing to contest the debt directly. The third," she paused, "the third told me to find a husband." Nathaniel set his book down flat. "Which third?" "Patterson," she said. "James Patterson, on Courthouse Row." Something tightened in Nathaniel's jaw. "Patterson was on the county bench 4 years ago," he said, "during one of the Voss land disputes." The silence that followed had the quality of two people arriving at the same conclusion from different directions and stopping when they see each other there. "How connected is he?" Abigail asked. "Connected enough," Nathaniel said quietly, "that it would need to be done carefully." She noticed the "it." She noticed the "would need." She did not comment on them. She let them sit where he had put them, and she kept her eyes on her book. He left the library that morning later than usual. She watched him go, and she noticed again the shoulders less rigid than they had been. Something loosening in the careful architecture of him. Slowly. Not all at once, but measurably. She was also afraid. She was afraid in the specific practical way of a woman who has learned to be precise about her fear. Not of him, not of the conversations, but of what she was beginning to allow herself to want. Not love. Not yet. Something simpler and more dangerous than love, she was beginning to want to trust someone. And trust for a woman in her position was not a feeling, it was a liability. She reminded herself of this every morning before she walked into the library. She reminded herself of it on the morning he was waiting for her when she arrived already in the chair, already with two cups of coffee on the table, one on each side, as though it had been done without thinking about whether it was appropriate or what it signaled or what she would make of it. She sat down. She took the cup. She opened her book. "Thank you," she said. "It was no trouble," he said. They read in silence for several minutes. Then he said, without looking up from his page, "My father built this library." She looked up. He was still looking at his book. He believed. Nathaniel said that a man without books was a man who had agreed to be smaller than he was. He used to say that the books were not for decoration. They were for... He paused. For taking up space. In the mind. For making sure there was always more room in there than the world could fill up with lesser things. Abigail looked at the shelves around them. Hundreds of books. Floor to ceiling on three walls. "He sounds," she said, "like someone my father would have liked." Nathaniel looked at her then. "He would have liked your father," he said. "He believed in the same things." A pause. "He also died before he could act on most of them. He left me the plantation and the library, and the instruction to be a man of principle, and I..." He stopped. She waited. "I became a very principled man," he said with a flatness that was not self-pity, but something more precise than that self-knowledge and its particular bitterness. "In every room where principle cost me nothing." The admission dropped between them like a stone, dropped into still water, and the silence that followed it moved in rings. Abigail looked at him for a long moment. "Mr. Whitcomb," she said carefully, "may I say something that is not what you are expecting me to say?" He looked at her. "In my experience, Miss Mercer, that is the only kind of thing you say." "You are not a cruel man because you feel nothing," she said. Her voice was even direct, the same voice she used for legal observations. Not soft, not performing gentleness. "You are cruel when you are cruel because you are terrified that someone will find out that you do." He went very still. "The Latin remark," she said. "In the parlor. That was not the remark of a man who doesn't care what other people think. That was the remark of a man who needs the room to see him as untouchable. Because if they see him as untouchable, no one will try to touch the thing underneath that you have been guarding since your father died." The silence was enormous. Nathaniel looked at her with an expression she had not seen on his face before. Not the locked door look. Not the controlled lawyer's stillness, but something rawer than either. Something that looked briefly like a man standing in a room he had walked out of years ago and finding it exactly as he left it. Then he stood up. He picked up his book. He walked to the shelves. He stood there with his back to her, one hand on the shelf, and he did not speak for a long moment. When he finally turned around, his expression had reassembled itself. Not fully, not the way it used to be, but enough that he could look at her directly. "You are," he said, "a very inconvenient person to have in one's library."
"I know," she said. "I apologize."
"No, you don't," he said.
"No,"
she agreed.
"I don't."
He almost smiled again.
Almost.
And then he walked out of the library for the second time with his back straight and his book under his arm, and she sat alone with the two coffee cups and the morning light and the particular feeling of a woman who has just said something true and is waiting to find out what it costs her. 2 days later, it was Clara who came to find her. Not in the corridor. In the servants' room. Late afternoon. She came in without knocking, which was unusual enough for Clara that Abigail looked up immediately from the mending she was pretending to care about. Clara's face was different. Not the performance face. The real one.
"My aunt received a letter this morning," Clara said. from Richmond. She stopped in the center of the room and she looked at Abigail with the expression of a woman delivering news she wishes she did not have. Eleanor Whitcomb is arriving Thursday, not at the end of the month. Thursday. Abigail set down the mending. She wrote to Nathaniel as well, Clara said. I saw his face when Henderson gave him the letter at luncheon. She paused. He went white, which is the most I have ever seen him show. Why is she coming early? Abigail asked. Clara looked at her steadily. Because someone wrote to her from this house, she said. I don't know who, but someone told her that Nathaniel has been spending his mornings in the library with the paid companion and that his behavior at the party last week was aberrant. Aberrant. The word sat in the air between them like a verdict. She is coming, Clara said, to correct the situation. Abigail was quiet for a moment. Then she said with the same steadiness she used for everything, How much time do we have?
4 days, Clara said.
4 days. Abigail looked at the window. The summer light was long and gold, in that way it gets in Virginia in late afternoon when the heat is still there, but the worst of it has passed, and the whole day seems briefly deceptively at peace.
Thank you, she said.
What are you going to do? Clara asked. Abigail looked at her carefully. She thought about the ledger in her trunk. She thought about the county registry notes. She thought about the legal phrasing that didn't exist until 6 months after her father supposedly signed the document that had taken their house. She thought about Nathaniel standing at the shelf with his back to her, one hand on the spine of a book, and the slight loosening in his shoulders each morning, and the two coffee cups on the table. She thought about Eleanor Whitcomb arriving on Thursday to correct the situation. I'm going to finish what I started, Abigail said. Clara looked at her for a long moment. Then she nodded, once firm, the nod of a young woman who has decided something in her own quiet interior and is not yet ready to say it out loud, but is ready to act on it. She left the room. Abigail sat alone. Outside, the summer evening pressed on. Somewhere in the county, Harlan Voss went about his business with the easy confidence of a man who had never been held accountable for anything he had done. Somewhere on the Richmond Road, Eleanor Whitcomb was no doubt already composing her corrections, and in the library down the East Corridor, the book Nathaniel had been reading that morning was still on the table where he had left it. She had noticed it when she passed. He had left it open face down, the way you leave a book when you intend to come back. Abigail picked up her Blackstone from the table beside her bed. She turned to the section on fraudulent conveyance. She began to read. Thursday was 4 days away. 4 days was enough time if you used every hour of it to make yourself impossible to ignore. She intended to use every hour. Eleanor Whitcomb arrived on a Thursday afternoon, and the whole house knew it before her carriage reached the gate. Henderson straightened his posture. The kitchen went quiet. Two of the housemaids who had been arguing in the back corridor separated and found separate rooms to occupy. Mrs. Bellamy, who was not a nervous woman, set down her embroidery 3 times in the space of an hour and picked it up again without making any progress. Clara found Abigail in the upstairs corridor and said nothing. She only looked at her with the particular expression of a person who has given a warning and is now watching it arrive. Abigail had spent the 4 days well. She had finished the section on fraudulent conveyance. She had gone back through her ledger notes twice, checking every reference, every date, every shift in legal phrasing that she had tracked across the county's official documents over the past 8 months. She had written out the argument in full clean sequential, the way her father had taught her to prepare a case, starting with the undisputable facts and building outward until the conclusion was the only thing left standing. She had done this in the back of the blank ledger in her smallest, most careful hand on 3 pages she had folded and placed inside the cover of her Blackstone. She had not shown it to Nathaniel. She had considered it. Every morning when she walked into the library and found him already there, the two cups on the table. The book open the shoulders, slightly less rigid than the morning before, she had considered it. She had decided against it. Not because she did not trust him. She was beginning to trust him in the careful, incremental way she trusted anything that had not yet given her a reason not to. She had decided against it because the argument needed to be hers first. Complete, defensible, and hers. Before she handed it to anyone else, she heard the carriage. She was in the servant's sitting room with a pile of Mrs. Bellamy's correspondence when the sound of wheels on the drive carried through the window, followed by the particular quality of silence that falls over a house when the person who owns its atmosphere has arrived. She stayed where she was. She kept working through the correspondence. She sorted, she sealed, she stacked. She breathed. She heard Eleanor Whitcomb's voice in the entrance hall below. It was not a loud voice. That was the first thing. Abigail had expected loud, the way powerful women in novels are always loud, commanding theatrical filling rooms with their presence, the way water fills a vessel. Eleanor Whitcomb's voice was not like that. It was quiet and precise, and absolutely certain of itself, the voice of a woman who had never needed to raise her volume because she had never needed to compete for the room's attention. The room had always already been hers. "Where is my son?" she said. Henderson murmured something. "Then tell him I am here," Eleanor said. "And tell Mrs. Bellamy I will take tea in the front parlor in 20 minutes. A pause. "And Henderson," she said in exactly the same tone, "the library. Who has been using it in the mornings?" Abigail's hands went still on the correspondence. Henderson's answer was too quiet to hear. Another pause. "I see," Eleanor said. And then the sound of her steps, unhurried and deliberate, moving toward the parlor. Abigail set the letters down. She put her hands flat on the table. She breathed. She thought about her father standing in courtrooms full of men who had already decided, and she thought about the 3 pages folded inside her Blackstone, and she thought about the word, yet the word she had used on the first morning in the library, when Nathaniel had asked if she could prove the document was forged. Yet. She had said yet. She picked the letters back up. She kept working. Nathaniel came to the library the next morning, looking like a man who had spent the night in an argument he had not been permitted to win. He was dressed coat-cravat, the full formal day wear he had stopped wearing to their morning sessions 2 weeks in, and he sat down in his chair without touching the coffee cup Henderson had left on the table, and he looked at the far wall with the expression of a man recalibrating. Abigail sat down across from him. She opened her Blackstone. She said nothing. He lasted 4 minutes. "She knows," he said. "I assumed," Abigail said. "She does not know the content of our conversations." His voice was careful. "She knows the fact of them. She considers it." He stopped. "Aberrant," Abigail offered. He looked at her. "Where did you hear that word?" "It doesn't matter," she said. "Is she wrong?" A long pause. "No," he said finally. "She is not wrong that it is unusual. She is wrong about what it means." "What does she think it means?" He looked at the table. "She thinks you are using your position, your knowledge, to secure an advantage you would not otherwise have access to." A pause. "She used the word calculated." Abigail absorbed this. She thought about the way she had walked into the library that first morning, the choice not to retreat, the decision to sit down and open her book and be exactly who she was. She thought about whether that was calculation. She thought about the difference between a person who acts with purpose and a person who acts with manipulation, and she thought about how rarely those in power distinguished between the two, when the person acting was a woman without money. "And what do you think it means?" she asked. Nathaniel looked at her for a long moment. "I think," he said slowly, "that I have had more honest conversation in this room in the past 3 weeks than I have had in the past 3 years anywhere else." A pause. "I don't know what to do with that yet, but I know it is not nothing." The admission cost him something. She could see it in the set of his jaw, the particular tension of a man saying a true thing in a house where true things had not been welcome. "Mr. Whitcomb," she said carefully, "I need to show you something." She reached into her Blackstone and took out the 3 folded pages. She unfolded them and placed them on the table between them, smoothed flat with the same 2-finger press she gave to everything. He looked at the pages. He looked at her. "Read the 3rd paragraph," she said. he read. She watched his face while he read. She watched the progression, the initial scan of a man moving quickly, then the slowdown, the return to the beginning of the paragraph, the second reading that was slower and more careful. She watched his expression change from the polite attention of someone reading a document they have been handed to the different, sharper attention of a person who has encountered something they were not expecting to find. He read all three pages. When he finished, he set them down, and he looked at her across the table with an expression she had not seen on his face before. "You built this in 8 months," he said, "without access to legal resources, without counsel, without standing." "My father built part of it," she said. "He kept records. He always kept records. I only knew what to look for. Abigail." He used her given name without appearing to notice he had done it. This is a legitimate legal challenge. This is not a grievance. This is an argument. A structured, documented, defensible legal argument." "Yes," she said. "I know. If the phrasing irregularity can be verified against the county registry." "It can," she said. "I verified it myself 3 weeks ago." "You need someone with standing to bring the claim." "Yes," she said. "I know that too."
The silence that followed was different from the silences they had been sitting in for 3 weeks. It had weight and direction. It was the silence of a moment that knows what it is. Nathaniel looked at the pages. He looked at her. He looked back at the pages. Then he looked up with an expression that was complicated and clear at the same time, and he said, "I will need to think about the form of it. Whether it goes through the county court directly or through a formal complaint to the district, Patterson's involvement complicates the local channel." "Yes," she said. "I thought that too." "It will require depositions, documentation, probably 3 to 4 weeks of preparation before anything can be filed." He paused. "It will also," he stopped, "it will also make your mother very unhappy," Abigail said. He looked at her. "You don't have to do it," she said, directly, without softening it. "I am not asking you to do it. I showed you because you asked 3 weeks ago what proof would look like. This is what it looks like. What you do with that is your decision." He was quiet for a long moment.
"I know," he said. And the way he said it, not dismissively, but with the weight of a man who understands exactly what he is choosing between, told her more than anything else he had said in 3 weeks of mornings. Eleanor Whitcomb came to the library that afternoon. Abigail was not there. She had gone back to her duties after their morning session, but she heard about it from Clara, who had been passing in the corridor and had heard voices through the door and had, without apparent guilt, stood close enough to the wall to listen. "She told him," Clara said, keeping her voice low in the corner of the upstairs hall where they had developed the habit of brief conferences, "that this has gone far enough." Those were her exact words, "far enough." Clara's eyes were sharp and unhappy. "She told him that the Bellamy connection was the correct path, that the arrangement with my family was sensible and safe, and that a man of his position did not rebuild his standing in this county by entertaining the ambitions of a penniless woman who had gotten above herself." Abigail kept her expression still. "What did he say?"
"He said—"
Clara stopped, started again. She looked slightly amazed by what she was about to report. "He said, 'Mother, I would ask you not to speak about Miss Mercer in that manner.' And she said, 'Then I would ask you to give me a reason why I should not.' And he said—" another pause. "'Because she is the most honest person in this house, and I find I am no longer interested in surrounding myself exclusively with comfortable liars.'" The corridor was very quiet. Abigail stood very still.
"She left the library," Clara said, "without another word, which my aunt says is more frightening than if she had shouted."
Abigail believed it. She believed it more fully. 2 days later, when Eleanor Whitcomb appeared in the doorway of the servant's sitting room and looked at Abigail with the quiet surgical attention of a woman who has identified the source of a problem and has come to assess the scope of the operation required to remove it, Abigail stood up. She did not curtsy. She had thought about it. The curtsy was technically appropriate, the social gesture of a woman of her station toward a woman of Eleanor's. But something in her was done with performance. She stood, and she met Eleanor's eyes, and she waited.
Eleanor looked at her for a long moment. She was a handsome woman, older upright, wearing the kind of dress that communicated its expense without advertising it. She had Nathaniel's eyes. The same controlled intelligence in them, but without whatever it was that was beginning to soften in his, without the locked door quality, the awareness of what was behind the door. Eleanor's eyes were the eyes of a woman who had decided long ago that whatever was behind the door was less important than the door remaining shut.
"Miss Mercer," Eleanor said.
"Mrs. Whitcomb," Abigail said. "I am going to say something to you plainly," Eleanor said. "I do not believe in approaching this kind of situation with ambiguity."
"I appreciate that," Abigail said.
"You are intelligent," Eleanor said. The word came out as something between an observation and an accusation. "My son is not a man who is easily impressed. The fact that you have impressed him tells me you are more capable than your station suggests. I am not insulting you. I am being precise."
"I understand," Abigail said.
"I am also telling you," Eleanor continued in exactly the same tone, "that intelligence without position is a lamp without oil. It is capable of light. It does not produce it." She paused. "My son has responsibilities to this family, to this county, to arrangements that were made long before you arrived at this house. His distraction is understandable. It is also finished."
Abigail looked at her steadily.
"Mrs. Whitcomb, may I ask you a question?"
A slight pause.
Eleanor had not expected to be asked a question.
"You may."
"When you say his distraction is finished," Abigail said, "do you mean that you have told him so, or that he has agreed?"
The silence that followed that question was a different kind of silence than anything that had come before. It was the silence of a woman who has walked into a room expecting to deliver a verdict and has found that the defendant has questions about jurisdiction.
"That," Eleanor said after a moment, "is not your concern."
"With respect," Abigail said, "it is the only part of this conversation that concerns me at all."
Eleanor looked at her.
For the first time, something moved in her expression that was not controlled. A flicker, small and quickly suppressed, of something that might have been surprise and might have been very distantly something harder to name.
"You are," Eleanor said quietly, "either very brave or very foolish."
"My father always said those were the same thing," Abigail said.
"Under the right circumstances."
Eleanor left the room without responding. Abigail sat back down. She was shaking slightly. Not much. Enough that she pressed her hands flat on her knees and breathed the scholar's breath in through the nose, slow disciplined, until the shaking stopped. She had 4 days left before Eleanor's planned departure. She had been tracking this the way she tracked everything. 4 days before the situation either resolved or exploded. It exploded in 3. The evening of the 3rd day, Henderson came to find Abigail in the servant's sitting room with a face that was as controlled as ever and eyes that were telling a different story. He handed her a folded note and said in a voice carefully drained of expression, "From Mrs. Whitcomb, Miss, the elder Mrs. Whitcomb." Abigail opened it. The note was brief, precise, in Eleanor's handwriting, which was exactly what you would expect: upright, clear, no wasted loops or ornamental flourishes. It said, "A document has come to my attention regarding the estate of one Reverend Thomas Mercer, deceased. Given the nature of certain recent conversations in this house, I believe the matter should be addressed at a county hearing. I have spoken to Justice Holt, who has agreed to convene a proceeding. The hearing is scheduled for Friday morning. Your attendance is required. E.W. Abigail read it twice. Then she folded it along its original creases and placed it on the table. Justice Holt, the red-faced planter from the party, the one who had laughed softly when Nathaniel had spoken in Latin, the one who had tobacco fields 3 miles south and interests that ran, as Nathaniel had said, in old arrangements with certain county families, Voss's allies. This was not a hearing to address the matter. This was a hearing to end it, to produce whatever version of the debt document Eleanor had obtained or had had obtained, and to bury Abigail Mercer under the weight of it so completely that no conversation in any library in Virginia would ever resurrect her. Abigail sat very still for exactly 30 seconds. Then she stood up, took her Blackstone from the shelf, took out the 3 folded pages,
and walked down the east corridor to the library. Nathaniel was there. She had not known he would be. It was evening, not morning, but she had hoped, and he was. He was sitting in his chair, with a book he was not reading, holding it the way people hold things when they are thinking about something else entirely. He looked up when she came in. He saw her face. He set the book down. She put the letter on the table in front of him without speaking. He read it. His expression did not change while he read, but his hands, she noticed, tightened once on the edge of the paper, and then deliberately loosened. "Holt," he said. "Yes." "Friday." "Yes." He set the letter down. He looked at the three folded pages beside it. Her pages, the argument she had built in 8 months from nothing but her father's records and her own careful mind. He looked at them for a long time. "This is her move," he said.
"Yes,"
Abigail said. "She got there before me. I should have anticipated that." "You couldn't have anticipated the speed," he said. "She has been planning this since before she arrived." Something in Abigail went cold and clear, and very still the particular clarity that comes not from the absence of fear, but from the presence of purpose. "Then I have until Friday morning," she said. "That is enough time." "For what?" he said. She looked at him across the table in the last light of the summer evening in his father's library, surrounded by his father's books, and she told him the truth, without softening it or performing it or making it smaller than it was. "To make sure," she said, "that when I stand in that room on Friday, every word I say is so precise, so documented, and so unassailable that the only way they can discredit it is by discrediting themselves." A pause. "And to decide whether you are going to be in that room when I do." The silence that followed was the most honest silence they had ever sat in. Nathaniel looked at her. She watched the thing move across his face, the locked door expression, and then underneath it, the door itself, and underneath that, the thing that had been behind it all along. Not cruelty, not coldness. A man who had watched his father die with more principles than victories, who had spent 15 years deciding that safety was the same as integrity, who had been very, very good at being the most intelligent person in the room, and had never once let that intelligence cost him anything that mattered. Until 3 weeks of mornings, and one woman in a gray dress, who had answered him in three languages and hadn't stopped answering him since. "I will be in that room," he said. "You don't have to be," she said. "I mean that. This is my fight. I am not placing it on your shoulders." "I know you're not," he said. "I'm placing it there myself." A pause. The first voluntary pause she had ever seen from him. Not the pause of a man controlling his reaction, but the pause of a man choosing his words because he wants them to be accurate. "For 35 years, I have been intelligent in rooms where intelligence cost me nothing. I have been principled in situations where principle was convenient. I have been..." He stopped. "I have been exactly the man this county expected me to be, and I have been very comfortable, and I have been a coward." The word dropped between them with the weight of something that had been waiting a long time to be said. "I am done being comfortable," he said. Abigail looked at him for a long time. She thought about her father. She thought about courtrooms full of men who had already decided. She thought about the house in March, and the sheriff who hadn't looked at the paper, and three lawyers who had told her to find a husband. She thought about what it meant, what it actually practically materially meant, to not be alone in a room where the room had already decided against you. "Then we have work to do," she said. "And we have 3 days to do it." He nodded once. He reached for his pen. She sat down, opened her Blackstone, and began. Outside the library windows, the Virginia summer held the last of its light for as long as it could. The county went about its business in the dark below Harlan Voss, in his comfortable house just as Holt, with his comfortable certainties, Eleanor Whitcomb, with her quiet, precise, absolutely certain voice. They did not know what was being built in that library. They did not know that on Friday morning the woman they were planning to silence was going to walk into that room with 8 months of documented evidence and a voice that had been waiting its entire life for exactly this moment. They did not know that she would not be walking in alone. They worked through the night.
Not dramatically, not with any sense of performance or romance about it. They worked the way people work when there is real work to do and not enough time to do it steadily, methodically, without wasted motion. Nathaniel pulled three volumes from the shelves that Abigail had not been able to access on her own, a bound collection of county court proceedings from 1810 through 1814, a registry of certified notaries active in the district, and a thin pamphlet from the Virginia legislature, recording the exact dates of statutory amendments to the county debt code. Abigail laid her three pages flat on the table, and they went through them line by line, checking every reference against the source documents, closing every gap that a hostile examiner might exploit. Henderson brought a lamp at 9 o'clock without being asked. He set it on the table between them, looked at neither of them directly, and left without a word. Abigail thought that was the most eloquent thing anyone had done in that house all week. By midnight, they had confirmed every date in her argument. By 2 in the morning, they had identified the notary whose name appeared on the Voss document, a man named Creel, who had, according to the registry, surrendered his notarial commission in the spring of 1813, a full year and a half before the date on the document he had allegedly certified. Abigail stared at that entry for a long moment. "He wasn't just using language that didn't exist yet," she said quietly. "He used a notary who hadn't been authorized to certify anything for over a year." Nathaniel looked at the registry entry. His jaw was tight. "Two independent defects," he said. "Either one alone might be argued around. Both together." "Cannot be argued around," Abigail said. "No," he said. "They cannot." She wrote it out. Clean, numbered, precise. The argument now had two pillars instead of one, and each pillar was independently sufficient to bring the document down. She wrote it the way her father had taught her. Start with what cannot be disputed, build toward what cannot be denied, end with the conclusion that is the only thing left standing when everything else has been examined. At 3 in the morning, Nathaniel set down his pen and looked at what she had produced. "Your father," he said, "taught you to do this." "He taught me to think this way," she said. "I taught myself to do it." He looked at her. "Yes," he said. "I can see that." She did not allow herself to feel too much about that. There was no time. She capped the ink, folded the final pages, and placed them inside the Blackstone. "You should sleep," Nathaniel said. "So should you," she said. "I won't," he said. "Neither will I," she said. They looked at each other across the table in the lamplight. And there was something in that moment, not romantic, not yet something simpler and more durable than romance. The particular recognition of two people who have been in some fundamental way alone for a long time and have just discovered they are not. Then Abigail picked up her book and walked back down the corridor to her room. She lay down. She did not sleep. She stared at the ceiling, and she thought about Friday morning, which was now 31 hours away. And she breathed the scholar's breath, and she waited for the sky outside her window to begin to lighten. It did eventually. Everything eventually does. The morning before the hearing was the strangest day Abigail had spent at Whitcomb Hall, and that was a significant distinction given the competition. Eleanor did not speak to her. This was deliberate, not the absence of speech, but its active architectural removal, the way you remove a load-bearing element to see if the structure falls. Eleanor moved through the house with her quiet, precise authority, and she looked through Abigail in every corridor and every room as though Abigail were a draft from an improperly fitted window, noticeable in its effect not worth addressing directly. Mrs. Bellamy was nervous in a way she was trying to conceal behind an unusual volume of instructions about correspondence and shawl placement. She did not know the full shape of what was happening, but she was a woman who had navigated enough drawing rooms to feel weather coming before it arrived. And the weather in Whitcomb Hall that Thursday had the particular pressure of a sky that has made up its mind. Clara found Abigail after luncheon. "She spoke to Holt again this morning," Clara said, keeping her voice low. "She sent Henderson with a note, and Holt sent one back within the hour." "What did it say?" Abigail asked. "I don't know. But after she read it, she was satisfied.
in the way she is satisfied when she has confirmed something she already knew.
Clara paused. She is very certain of Friday Abigail.
She should be, Abigail said. She built it carefully.
Are you ready? Abigail thought about the pages inside her Blackstone. She thought about the notary named Creel, who had not been authorized to certify anything since the spring of 1813. She thought about Nathaniel's face in the lamplight at 3 in the morning, when he had said, "I can see that."
Yes, she said. I'm ready.
Clara looked at her for a long moment. Then she said something Abigail had not expected.
I want to be there, Clara said. Tomorrow, at the hearing. I want to be in the room.
Clara, I know what it means, Clara said firmly. I know what my aunt will say about it. I know what it will cost me in terms of her approval. The word came out with a slight edge that was as close as Clara ever came to contempt. I have been in this house for 2 years performing approval for people who have never once asked what I actually thought about anything. I am done with it. She straightened. I want to be there.
Abigail looked at the young woman in front of her 19 years old, lovely and miserable and awake, in a way she had not been when Abigail arrived, as though something in the past 3 weeks had cracked a window open in her that she was now unwilling to close.
Then be there, Abigail said. Clara nodded once. Then she turned and walked back toward her aunt's sitting room with her posture correct and her expression composed and something entirely new in the set of her shoulders. That evening, Nathaniel came to the servant's sitting room door. He knocked. Abigail opened it. He stood in the corridor looking like a man who has rehearsed something and arrived to find that what he rehearsed is not quite right for the actual moment.
I want to tell you something, he said. Before tomorrow.
All right, she said. He was quiet for a moment. When I was practicing law in Richmond, he said there was a case, a family tenant, farmers 3 generations on the same land. The landowner died, and his son decided to renegotiate the lease terms in a way that was not legal, but was sufficiently obscured in paperwork, that proving the illegality would have required a long fight against a man with significant resources. He paused. I reviewed the case. I could see the argument. I chose not to take it. Another pause. I told myself it was because the argument was insufficient. It wasn't. The argument was solid. I didn't take it because taking it would have meant making an enemy of a family with considerable influence in the district, and I had just returned home after my father's death to manage the plantation, and I decided that being cautious was the same as being practical.
Abigail said nothing. She waited.
Those farmers lost the land, he said. They left the county. I don't know where they went. He looked at her directly. I have thought about that case approximately once a week for 4 years. And I have not done anything about it. And I told myself each time I thought about it that it was too late, that the time had passed, that there was nothing to be done now. He stopped. Tomorrow, he said. I am going to do something about it. Not about that case that time is genuinely past, but about the habit. He held her gaze. I want you to know that I understand what I am choosing. I am not walking into that room without understanding what it will cost. I am choosing it anyway. Abigail looked at him for a long time.
Why are you telling me this tonight? She asked.
Instead of just showing up tomorrow. Because, he said carefully, I did not want you to spend tonight thinking you might be alone in that room. I wanted you to know before you needed to know it. The corridor was very quiet around them.
Thank you, she said.
He nodded once. He started to turn.
Nathaniel, she said. His given name. The first time.
He turned back.
My father would have liked you, she said.
The man you're becoming. He would have liked him considerably.
Something moved across his face, not the almost smile. Something quieter and deeper than that. Something that lived below the level of expression.
He held her gaze for one more moment. Then he walked back down the corridor, and she closed the door and sat down and breathed.
Friday morning arrived the way significant mornings always do, with an indifference to its own significance that is almost insulting.
The sun came up. The birds started. Henderson made coffee. The world did not arrange itself into any particular acknowledgement of what was about to happen in the county courthouse on Courthouse Row. Abigail dressed carefully. She had one dress better than the gray one, a dark blue wool that had been her mother's remade twice to fit her pressed. So many times, the fabric had a particular smoothness to it that was not quite the smoothness of new cloth, but was not shabbiness either. She put it on. She pinned her hair correctly. She took her Blackstone from the shelf. She walked downstairs. The entrance hall was occupied. Eleanor stood near the door in full visiting dress, composed and quiet and certain. Nathaniel stood to one side of her in his best coat. Mrs. Bellamy fluttered near the parlor doorway, clearly unsure of her role in a situation that had grown considerably beyond her management. And Clara stood near the stairs in her second-best dress, with her chin at an angle that told anyone paying attention that she had made a decision and was not going to be moved from it. Eleanor looked at Clara.
"You are not attending," she said.
"I am," Clara said.
"Clara."
"Aunt,"
Clara said quietly.
"I am attending."
Mrs. Bellamy made a small, distressed sound. Eleanor looked at her niece with the surgical attention she had turned on Abigail 3 days ago, and Clara met it with the particular steadiness of a young woman who has finally found something worth being steady for. Eleanor said nothing further to Clara. She looked at Abigail.
"Shall we go?" she said.
It was not a question. The courthouse on Courthouse Row was a plain two-story building that smelled of old wood and older decisions. The main room where civil hearings were held had a long table at the front for the examining justice and two rows of benches for observers. By the time they arrived, the benches were already occupied. This was the first thing Abigail noticed, and it hit her like cold water. She had expected a small proceeding. A handful of witnesses, an examiner, the relevant parties. She had not expected an audience. The benches held perhaps 30 people. County men, lawyers, merchants, two or three women. Word had gotten out the way word always gets out in a county where the most powerful family has called a hearing on a Thursday afternoon. She kept her expression still. She kept walking. Justice Holt sat at the front table. He was the same red-faced man from the parlor, the one who had laughed softly at the Latin remark, and he watched Abigail enter the room with the comfortable authority of a man who already knows how this afternoon is going to go. Harlan Voss was in the room. She had not expected that either. He was seated to the right of the front table, a heavy-set man in his 50s, with the specific confidence of someone who has collected money from people who could not fight back and has come to find the process routine. He had a leather folder in front of him. He did not look at Abigail when she came in. She looked at him for exactly as long as she needed to, which was long enough to confirm that he was who she thought he was, and that the leather folder was where the document would be. Then she sat down at the left side of the front table, with her Blackstone in her hands, and she waited. Nathaniel sat beside her. Eleanor sat in the front bench, with the expression of a woman watching a play she has written herself. Holt called the proceeding to order, with the brisk efficiency of a man who considers this a formality. He recited the claim the estate of Reverend Thomas Mercer, deceased, had outstanding debt against it. The claimant Harlan Voss had produced documentation. The question before the court was the validity of the estate's obligation. "The document," Holt said, nodding to Voss. Voss opened his leather folder and produced the paper. Abigail had never seen the original. She had only seen a copy obtained through the courthouse clerk on the morning she had gone to retrieve non-existent correspondence for Mrs. Bellamy. She looked at the original now as it was passed to the table, and she felt briefly the same cold clarity she had felt in the library 3 nights ago, that particular stillness that lives at the center of a situation you have prepared for. Holt examined the document. He nodded. "The claim appears valid on its face," he said. "The debt is recorded against the Mercer estate in the sum of $400, signed in September of 1814, notarized by one J. Creel. Is there anyone here who contests the claim?" He was looking at the document when he said it, not at Abigail. The question was posed to the room with the inflection of a question that does not expect an answer. "I contest it," Abigail said. The room shifted. Holt looked up. Several of the men on the benches turned.
Voss, for the first time, looked at her directly.
Miss Mercer, Holt said with the particular patience of a man addressing someone who has misunderstood their role. You are here as the interested party regarding the estate. You are not.
I am contesting the document, she said. Her voice was even and clear, and carried to every corner of the room without effort. On two independent grounds, each of which is documented and verifiable. I would ask permission to present them.
Holt looked at her. He looked at Eleanor. Eleanor's expression was unchanged, absolutely still, absolutely certain, the expression of a woman who has played chess long enough to know that this is a move she anticipated and has already addressed. A woman has no legal standing to contest a debt claim directly, Holt said. The proceeding requires a male representative of the estate.
The estate has no male representative, Abigail said. My father died without male heirs. The law does not remove the debt simply because the debtor is female. I would suggest it cannot logically remove the right to contest it on the same grounds.
Several people in the room shifted. A man near the back, a lawyer she did not recognize, leaned forward slightly.
Holt said, Miss Mercer, I'll represent the estate.
Nathaniel's voice.
The room went very quiet. He had stood up. He was standing beside Abigail at the left side of the table, and he had his hands flat on the surface, and he was looking at Holt with the expression of a man who has been in courtrooms before and knows exactly what he is doing in one.
I am Nathaniel Whitcomb, he said, which was unnecessary, since everyone in the room knew exactly who he was.
I am a member of the Virginia Bar. I will represent the estate of Reverend Thomas Mercer in this proceeding. The estate's representative is now present. May we proceed?
Holt stared at him. From the front bench, Eleanor Whitcomb did not move a single muscle. But something, some infinitesimal thing, shifted in the precise architecture of her stillness.
Nathaniel. His mother's voice. Quiet. Absolute. Sit down.
No, ma'am, he said. The two words fell into the room like stones into standing water, and the silence that spread out from them reached every corner of that courthouse before anyone breathed again.
Holt recovered first, because men like Holt are good at recovering. It is the primary skill set of someone who has spent years presiding over outcomes that were decided before the proceedings began.
Very well, he said with the tightness of a man revising his expectations under pressure. Mr. Whitcomb, you may speak to the claim.
Nathaniel looked at Abigail, a single glance brief direct, carrying a complete sentence in it go.
Abigail opened her Blackstone. She took out the pages. She smoothed them flat with two fingers, the way she smoothed everything, and she looked up at the room, at Holt, at Voss, at the men on the benches who had come expecting a foregone conclusion and were now visibly recalibrating, and she began. The document claims my father borrowed $400 against our property in September of 1814, she said. The document uses the phrase, pursuant to the provisions of the county debt registry, herein established. I will ask the court to note that the county debt registry provision referenced by that language was not enacted by the Virginia legislature until March of 1815. A document authored in September of 1814 cannot reference a provision that did not exist for another 6 months. I have here the certified legislative record of that enactment date. She placed the first document on the table. The room was absolutely still. Voss had not moved, but his hands on the leather folder had changed position. Furthermore, Abigail said, the document is notarized by 1 J. Creel. I have here the registry of certified notaries active in this county and district, which shows that James Creel surrendered his notarial commission in April of 1813, 16 months before he allegedly certified this document. A notary who is not commissioned cannot legally certify anything. A document certified by an uncommissioned notary has no legal standing. She placed the second document on the table beside the first. She looked up. Holt was staring at the documents. He was staring at them with the expression of a man who has been handed a situation he did not prepare for and is running through his options at considerable speed. Voss had finally looked away from her. He was looking at the table, at the leather folder, at nothing in particular, with the specific quality of attention of a man whose confidence has just been replaced by calculation. The lawyer near the back of the room, the one who had leaned forward earlier, had leaned forward further.
He was a young man, she noticed now, sharp-faced, attentive, writing something in a small notebook.
These are two independent defects, Abigail said. Either one alone renders the document legally insufficient. Together they constitute evidence of deliberate fraud.
She did not raise her voice. She did not need to.
I am asking this court to dismiss the claim, return the title to the Mercer estate, and examine how a document with these particular defects came to be brought before this proceeding in the first place.
The last sentence landed in the room and did not dissipate. It sat there specific and pointed, and every person in the room understood exactly what it was pointing at. Holt looked at Voss. Voss looked at Holt. The thing that passed between them in that look was not a communication. It was a recognition, two men discovering simultaneously that the ground they had been standing on had changed character without their permission, and that the woman who had changed it had documented everything.
The documents presented by Miss Mercer, Nathaniel said into the silence, are certified copies from the county and legislative records. They are not assertions, they are records. The court is welcome to verify them against the originals, which I have already arranged to have available. He paused. I would also note for the record that Harlan Voss has been party to three land disputes in this county in the past 4 years, two of which involved similar debt documentation against estates with no male representation. I believe those cases warrant review as well.
That was the moment the room broke open. Not loudly, not with shouting or dramatics. It broke the way ice breaks in spring, a crack and then a shift and then the whole surface moving at once. Three men in the back bench started talking to each other in low, urgent voices. The young lawyer was writing faster. Holt had pressed both hands flat on the table in front of him and was staring at the documents as though looking at them long enough might change what they said. Voss had stood up not dramatically, not with any statement, just stood up the way a man stands when the room has changed and he is calculating the most efficient exit.
Sit down, Mr. Voss, Nathaniel said. It was quiet. It was absolute. It was the voice of a man who has been a lawyer and a landowner, and the most respected person in the county, and who has just decided to use all of that for something that matters. Voss sat down. Holt called a recess. He used the word procedural, which was a way of buying time to figure out what had just happened to him and whether there was any version of it he could manage. He stood up and went into the anteroom with the tightness of a man who came to execute something and has discovered he is the one under examination. The room dissolved into noise the moment he left. Abigail stood very still at the table. Her hands were on the surface flat, the way Nathaniel's had been. Her pages were in front of her. The two certified documents were in front of her. She was looking at nothing in particular, a point slightly above the empty examiner's chair, and breathing the scholar's breath. In through the nose, slow, disciplined. She became aware of Clara beside her. Clara had crossed from the bench to the table without Abigail noticing, and she was standing there now with her hand on Abigail's arm, not dramatically, not with any performance, just a hand on an arm. Present, steady.
You did it, Clara said quietly.
It's not finished, Abigail said.
No, Clara said.
But you did it.
Nathaniel turned from the table and looked at Abigail with an expression that was entirely new. Not the locked door look. Not the almost smile. Not the controlled lawyer's attention. Just his face open without architecture, looking at her the way a person looks when they have stopped deciding what to show and have simply started being visible.
Your father, he said quietly enough that only she could hear it, would have been very proud of what just happened.
Abigail looked at him. She thought about her father standing in courtrooms full of men who had already decided. She thought about him losing and going back and losing again and going back again. Because the truth does not need you to win. It only needs you to say it. She thought about the fact that she had just said it. In a room full of people who had come expecting a foregone conclusion, with two cups of coffee on a library table and three pages built from 8 months of careful, solitary, invisible work, and one man standing up beside her when it counted. Her eyes were bright. She did not let them spill. She pressed her hands flat on the table and breathed. When Holt came back from the anteroom 20 minutes later,
He looked like a man who had made several phone calls he could not make and had come back to deal with what was in front of him. He sat down. He looked at the documents. He looked at Voss, who had not moved from his chair and was looking at the table with the specific stillness of a man performing patience while calculating outcomes. "The proceeding," Holt said carefully, "will be continued pending review of the documentation presented. The claim against the Mercer estate is suspended pending that review." He paused. He did not look at Eleanor. "The court will notify the relevant parties of the date for continuation." It was not a dismissal, but it was not what Eleanor had built it to be. Abigail gathered her pages. She closed her Blackstone. She stood up straight in her dark blue dress that had been her mother's pressed so many times. The fabric had a particular smoothness that was not quite new and not quite worn, and she turned toward the door. The room was still rearranging itself. People were standing, talking, moving. Voss was at the far end of the table, speaking in a low, rapid voice to a man Abigail did not recognize. The young lawyer near the back had put away his notebook and was watching Voss with the focused attention of someone who has found something worth watching. At the door, Eleanor Whitcomb was standing. She was not blocking the door. She was simply standing near it as she had stood near doors her entire life, as though every doorway was a position, and every position was a statement. She watched Abigail come toward her with the same quiet surgical attention she had brought to every encounter between them. Abigail did not slow down. She walked to the door, and she stopped in front of Eleanor Whitcomb, and she met the older woman's eyes directly. For a long moment, neither of them spoke. Then Eleanor said very quietly, "You are more formidable than I calculated."
"Yes," Abigail said.
"I know." Eleanor looked at her for one more moment. Then she stepped aside. Abigail walked through the door into the summer morning, and the heat of Virginia came up around her like something that had been waiting, and she stopped on the top step and breathed the air and let herself feel for exactly one moment the full weight of what had just happened in that room. Then she heard the door open behind her. She turned. Nathaniel stood there.
"It's not finished," she said, "because it wasn't. Holt would reconvene. Voss had allies. Eleanor was not done. The proceeding had been suspended, not resolved and suspended. Things had a way of coming back heavier than they left."
"No," Nathaniel said.
"It's not." He looked at her steadily. "But it has started. And this time, it has started correctly."
She looked at him. She thought about all the mornings in the library. She thought about the two coffee cups. She thought about three pages folded inside a law book and the particular sound of a man saying, "No, ma'am," to his mother in a room full of people who had never heard him say it before.
"Yes," she said.
"It has." Behind them, through the courthouse door, she could hear the room still unsettling itself. Voices movement. The sound of people adjusting to something they had not expected and were not yet sure what to do with. That sound, Abigail thought, was the sound of truth requiring no permission. Just someone willing to say it clearly enough in a room where it mattered at the exact moment it was needed. She turned and walked down the steps into the Virginia summer morning. Nathaniel walked beside her. Neither of them spoke for a while. They didn't need to. The county did not forget what happened in that courthouse on a Friday morning in the summer of 1816. Counties never forget things like that. They carry them the way rivers carry silt, invisibly constantly depositing them in unexpected places for years afterward. People who had been in the room told people who had not been in the room, and the telling changed slightly with each retelling. The way all true things do when they pass through enough mouths, but the core of it remained intact. A penniless woman in a dark blue dress had walked into a proceeding designed to silence her and had dismantled a fraudulent document with two independent legal arguments. And Nathaniel Whitcomb, the coldest, most carefully controlled man in Whitcomb County, had stood up beside her and said, "No, ma'am," to his own mother in front of 30 witnesses. That last part was the part people kept returning to. The ride back to Whitcomb Hall was quiet in the way that follows significant things. Not the uncomfortable quiet of people who have nothing to say, but the full quiet of people who have said enough for one morning and are letting it settle. Eleanor rode in the carriage with her hands folded and her eyes on the window and her expression giving nothing away. Mrs. Bellamy sat across from her
and managed through considerable effort to say absolutely nothing for the entire journey, which was the most useful thing she had contributed to the situation since it began. Clara sat beside Abigail and did not touch her arm again, but was close enough that the proximity itself was a statement. Nathaniel rode alongside the carriage on horseback. Abigail knew he was there without looking. She could hear his horse's steady pace on the summer road, and she thought about the word alongside, the particular meaning of it, how different it was from behind or ahead, what it required of a person to maintain it. When they arrived at the house, Eleanor went directly upstairs without speaking to anyone. Mrs. Bellamy followed the direction of least resistance and went to her sitting room. Clara excused herself with the brief firm nod that had become her signature gesture for decisions made and not up for discussion. Abigail went to the servant's sitting room. She sat down. She put her Blackstone on the table in front of her and she looked at it and she breathed. She was still sitting there when Nathaniel knocked. She had expected him to. She did not know what she expected him to say. "Come in," she said. He came in. He stood in the center of the room, not sitting, not leaning, simply standing the way he stood when he had something to say, and was choosing the words carefully. "The proceeding will reconvene within 30 days," he said. "Holt has no choice now that the documentation is on record. If he tries to close it without a ruling, the district examiner will take it up. There is also..." He paused. "The young lawyer in the back of the room. His name is Garrett Marsh. He is from Richmond, visiting his family in the county this week. He came to see me after you left the building." Abigail looked at him. "And he practices at the district level. He has been building a case against Voss for 18 months, based on the two earlier land disputes I mentioned in the hearing. He said..." Nathaniel stopped. Started again, with the expression of a man reporting something that has affected him more than he intends to show. "He said your documentation is the clearest evidence of Voss's method he has seen. He wants to use it, with your permission, in the district proceeding." Abigail was quiet for a moment. "My documentation," she said. "Your name on it," Nathaniel said. "Your argument, your records, your work. Marsh was very specific about that. He said he would not use it any other way." She looked at the Blackstone on the table. She thought about 8 months of careful, invisible work done in the margins of a life that had given her very little to work with. She thought about her father's ledger, her father's lessons, her father's voice telling her that truth doesn't need you to win, it only needs you to say it. It appeared she thought that sometimes saying it led to other people wanting to say it too. "Yes," she said, "with my permission." Nathaniel nodded. Then he was quiet for a moment, which was the quietness of a man who has delivered the practical information and has arrived at the thing he actually came to say. "I want to ask you something," he said. "All right," she said. "When this is resolved, the proceeding, the district case, all of it, what do you intend to do?" She looked at him. It was a direct question, and he was asking it the way he had asked her about property law on the first morning in the library, not testing, not performing interest, but genuinely asking. She gave it the same honest attention she had given that question. "I intend to teach," she said. "I have been thinking about it for some time. There are families in this county, tenant farmers, freed families, tradespeople whose daughters have no access to reading instruction past the age of 9 or 10. My father taught anyone who came to him. I want to do the same." She paused. "I will need a room, and books, and enough income to keep myself without a patron who owns the right to tell me what to say." Nathaniel looked at her for a long moment. "And if someone offered to provide those things without the ownership?" "Then I would want to know precisely what they wanted in return," she said. "Because in my experience, nothing is offered without terms, and the terms are where the truth lives." "Fair enough," he said. He reached into his coat and produced a folded document. He placed it on the table beside her Blackstone. "Those are the terms," he said. "Read them before you say anything." She looked at him. Then she looked at the document. Then she unfolded it and read. It was a deed, a land deed properly drafted with the signatures of two witnesses and the county seal. It conveyed a parcel of land, 2 acres adjacent to the county church road,
with a modest existing structure described as suitable for conversion to educational use into the name of Abigail Jane Mercer in fee. Simple with no encumbrance and no condition. Her name. The land. No strings. She read it twice. She read the legal description of the conveyance three times looking for the clause. There was no clause. It was clean. It was as far as she could determine from her reading of Blackstone's volume, 2 on property law, exactly what it appeared to be. She set it down. "This is in my name," she said. "Yes." With no condition of marriage or continued association or no condition of any kind, he said, "it is yours. Whatever happens between us or does not happen, it is yours. I want that to be absolutely clear before anything else is said." She looked at him. "Why?" "Because," he said with the directness of a man who has decided to stop performing and start speaking, "I want you to know that what I am about to say next is not connected to this deed. I want you to have the land regardless of your answer. I want you to be certain of that." "I am certain of it," she said. "I read the document." "Then I will say it." He looked at her directly, steadily, without the locked door expression, without the almost smile, without any of the careful architecture she had spent 3 weeks learning to read past, just his face open looking at hers. "I am not in love with the idea of you, Abigail. I am not in love with what you represent, or what you've shown me about myself, or the fact that you are the most honest person I have encountered in 35 years. Those things are true, but they are not what I mean." He paused. "I mean, I am in love with you specifically. The woman who comes to the library before 5 in the morning and reads property law because she refuses to be beaten by a system that was designed to ignore her. The woman who answered me in 3 languages and wasn't performing anything. She was simply being exactly who she was, and I was too stupid to recognize what that was worth until about 3 days later." Another pause. "I want to build a life with you, not as your patron, not as your rescuer, as your equal. And I use that word knowing full well that I have not always behaved as though I understood what it meant, and that it is going to require considerable consistent effort on my part to live up to it. I am asking for the opportunity to make that effort." The room was very still. Abigail looked at him for a long time. She thought about the first morning in the library, the choice not to retreat, the decision to sit down and open her book and be exactly who she was. She thought about 2 coffee cups on a table, and a man who had put one there without thinking about whether it was appropriate. She thought about the corridor outside the servant's sitting room, and the locked door expression, and the moment the door had opened. She thought about her father who had loved her mother in exactly the same way. Not as a possession, not as a performance, but as a person he had been lucky enough to find and smart enough to recognize. She thought about what she wanted. Not what was safe. Not what was practical. What she actually specifically wanted. "I am not easy to live with," she said. "I know," he said. "I will not stop arguing when I think you are wrong." "I would find it alarming if you did." "I intend to open that school," she said. "It will take my time and my attention, and it will occasionally take precedence over social obligations and household arrangements." "I will help you build it," he said. "That is not a negotiation. That is a statement of intent." She looked at him. She looked at the deed on the table. She looked at the Blackstone beside it, her father's book worn at the spine carried through everything. She looked at the man standing in the center of the servant's sitting room of his own house, asking her for something as though the asking itself was the most important thing, as though her answer was not a foregone conclusion, simply because he was rich and she was not. "Yes," she said. He let out a breath, a small involuntary thing, quickly controlled, but she caught it and she filed it away because it told her something true about what the asking had cost him. "Yes," she said again more completely. "I will build a life with you, but I will need you to understand something first." "Tell me," he said. "I have been invisible for a very long time," she said.
by circumstance, by poverty, by the particular determination of a world that was very invested in keeping women like me small. I am done with invisible. I will not perform smallness to make your county more comfortable. I will not soften my arguments in polite company. I will not pretend that the school is a charitable hobby rather than the most serious work I intend to do with my life. She met his eyes directly. If you want me, you want all of that. The whole of it. There is no version of me that comes without the library and the Latin and the three pages and the thing I said to your mother in the servant's sitting room. Nathaniel looked at her for a moment. Then he said, Abigail. I walked into a county hearing and said, no ma'am to Eleanor Whitcomb in front of 30 people. He paused. I think I have demonstrated that I want all of it. She almost smiled. For the first time in a very long time, she almost smiled with the full weight of it, not the controlled, careful expression she had worn for 11 months of invisibility, but the real thing coming up from somewhere she had kept carefully protected. Yes, she said. I reckon you have. The next 30 days were not quiet. Holt reconvened the proceeding as required, and this time, Garrett Marsh sat at the table alongside Nathaniel. Voss arrived with a lawyer of his own, a man from Richmond, with a smooth manner and an argument about document authenticity that collapsed inside 40 minutes under the combined pressure of Marsh's district-level precedents and Abigail's two-pillar documentary case. The notary issue in particular could not be argued around. A man who was not commissioned could not certify. The document fell. The title to the Mercer property was restored. Not to the house had been sold, but to whatever monetary value the county assessor assigned it, which was enough placed in Abigail's name by order of the proceeding to matter. Voss was referred to the district examiner for review of his two prior land disputes. Marsh took that referral and walked out of the courthouse with it tucked under his arm and the expression of a young lawyer who has just been given the case he has been building toward for 18 months. Holt presided over all of this with the expression of a man learning at considerable personal cost that the outcomes he had been managing were not as settled as he had believed. He did not apologize. Men like Holt do not apologize. But he presided correctly, which was the only thing Abigail had ever asked of the proceeding. Eleanor Whitcomb watched all of it. She had not left. Abigail had expected her to leave to return to Richmond, with her quiet, precise certainty, and her corrections, and her conviction that the situation had simply become unmanageable, and was therefore no longer worth managing. She did not leave. She stayed at Whitcomb Hall through the second proceeding, and through the week that followed, and she was present at dinner each evening, with the composed stillness of a woman who is processing something she has not yet finished processing. She did not speak to Abigail directly during this period, but she stopped looking through her. That was the first thing. The second thing happened on a Tuesday evening, 2 weeks after the second proceeding. Abigail was in the library. She had stopped thinking of it as Nathaniel's library, or his father's library, and had begun simply thinking of it as the library, which felt accurate going through a list of books she intended to request for the school's first collection. The door opened and Eleanor came in. Abigail looked up. Eleanor stood in the doorway with the expression of a woman who has made a decision about something and has come to execute it before she changes her mind. She was holding a box, a plain wooden box, medium-sized, carried in both hands, with the careful attention you give to something that has weight and value. She crossed the room and set the box on the table. She did not sit down. "These belong to my husband," she said. "Nathaniel's father." She looked at the box, then at Abigail. He was a man who believed in education. He believed in it in ways that this county did not always find convenient, and he was frequently told so, and he continued to believe it anyway. A pause. I did not always make that easy for him. I believed that the county's convenience was more important than his principles. The word came out with a slight difficulty, as though she was using it for the first time in a very long time. I have been thinking this past month about whether I was correct. Abigail looked at the box. The books inside, Eleanor said, are his. He collected them over 30 years. Legal texts, histories, scientific works, books of natural philosophy.
He intended at various points to donate them to some public purpose. He died before he settled on which one. She looked at Abigail directly. I am not apologizing. I want to be clear about that. I am not a woman who apologizes easily, and I do not intend to start by producing one that is less than fully meant. Another pause. But I am giving you these books. For the school. Because my husband would have given them himself, and I should have done it sooner, and these are the facts of the matter. Abigail looked at her for a long moment.
Thank you, she said. Simply. Directly. Without performance.
Eleanor nodded, once the same single nod that Clara had been doing for weeks, and Abigail understood now where Clara had learned it. Then she turned and walked back toward the door.
Mrs. Whitcomb, Abigail said.
Eleanor stopped.
He would have liked you, Abigail said. My father. He was stubborn about the right things, and wrong about others, and he loved his principles more than his comfort, and I think he would have recognized something of that in you. Even now.
Eleanor stood with her back to the room for a moment. When she turned around, her expression was exactly as composed as it always was, but something in it was not softer exactly. More honest. The way a face looks when it has stopped deciding what to show.
Your father, Eleanor said, raised a woman who walked into my son's library and refused to leave.
A pause. I find I cannot entirely disapprove of that. She left. Abigail sat alone in the library with the box of books and the book list and the deed to 2 acres on the county church road, and she breathed, not the scholar's breath this time, not the disciplined counting breath of a woman managing a situation. Just breath. The ordinary uncalculated breath of a person who has set something down and discovered that her hands are free.
The Mercer School opened on a morning in late summer, a year after Abigail had first arrived at Whitcomb Hall in a faded gray dress, carrying one trunk, and the expression of a woman who had learned to make herself invisible. She was not invisible anymore. The building was modest, 2 rooms, a small covered entrance, a yard with a well, but it was clean and solid, and the deed to the land was in her name, and the sign above the door read, Mercer School. In letters that Nathaniel had cut himself from a piece of cedar he had found in the back of the barn, because he had said he wanted to be useful, and she had told him that was a fine quality in a man. The families came in the morning. More than Abigail had expected, she had planned for 10 students, and 17 arrived, ranging in age from 6 to 14. Daughters of tenant farmers. Daughters of tradespeople. 2 girls whose mother was a freedwoman, who had walked 4 miles each way to bring them. A girl named Patience, whose father had told her the morning before that education was wasted on girls, and whose mother had brought her anyway quietly before her father was awake. Abigail stood in the doorway, and she looked at all of them, and she felt something she had not allowed herself to feel in a very long time. Not triumph, which was too sharp and too temporary. Something steadier. The particular feeling of a person who has found the exact right use for everything they are. Clara was there. She had come not as a student she had arranged through the widowed schoolmistress in town, and a considerable amount of quiet determination to begin her own studies in a more formal capacity, but to help on the first morning, which she said was the only kind of help that actually mattered. Nathaniel was there. He stood back from the door, far enough back that he was clearly not the center of this, not the patron presiding over his charity, but close enough that she could feel him there. Alongside. The way he had ridden alongside the carriage on the way back from the courthouse. And Eleanor Whitcomb was there. She had arrived unannounced, which was her way. She stood at the edge of the yard with her hands folded and her posture correct and her face doing its careful, composed thing, and she watched the girls go in through the door one by one. She watched a 6-year-old named Ruth, who had never held a book in her life, reach out and touch the spine of one of her late husband's volumes with one careful finger. The way you touch something you have been told is valuable and cannot yet believe is real. Eleanor watched that, and something in her face for the first time came fully undone. Not dramatically, not with tears or declarations, just a loosening. The architecture relaxing very slightly around the eyes. The expression of a woman who has lived long enough and carefully enough to recognize when she finally sees it the thing her husband had been trying to tell her for 30 years.
She did not stay long. She was not a woman who lingered in moments of softness. But before she left the yard, she crossed to where Abigail was standing, and she said quietly, "My husband's books are well placed." And then she left. Abigail watched her go. Inside the school, she could hear Clara's voice reading aloud to the younger girls, something simple, rhythmic, the beginning of a reading lesson. She could hear Ruth asking a question in the particular earnest voice of a child who does not yet know that questions are supposed to be rationed. Nathaniel came to stand beside her. They stood in the doorway together for a moment, not touching, just present side by side. "She'll be back," he said quietly, meaning Eleanor. "I know," Abigail said. "She won't admit it." "She doesn't have to," Abigail said. "She left the books." He looked at her. She looked at him. And then the almost smile, the thing she had been watching, almost happened for 3 weeks of mornings, finally arrived completely. It was quieter than she had imagined. More honest. The smile of a man who has stopped performing and started being and is discovering that being is considerably better. She did not perform her response. She simply looked at him fully, the way she looked at everything she was not going to make smaller than it was. "I have 17 students inside that door," she said. "I know," he said. "And a second room that needs bookshelves before October." "I'll build them," he said. "And a list of legal texts I need sourced from Richmond." "I'll write to Marsh," he said. "He owes us both a considerable favor." "He owes me," she said. "You get to ask him on my behalf." Nathaniel looked at her for a moment. Then he said, "Is that the first term of our partnership?" "It is the first stated term," she said. "There will be others." "I look forward to them," he said. And he meant it. She could hear it in his voice, the complete absence of performance, the sound of a man who has found the exact right use for himself and knows it. She turned back to the school. Inside, Ruth had asked another question, and Clara was answering it with the particular patience of someone who is discovering that she is good at something she was never given the chance to try. The morning light came through the two windows and fell across her father's books, on their temporary shelves, and across 17 girls who had been told in various ways and with various degrees of cruelty that their minds were not worth the trouble of filling. Abigail walked inside. She stood at the front of the room and she looked at those 17 faces looking back at her. Open, uncertain. Some of them frightened, and all of them present, and she thought about everything it had taken to arrive at this exact doorway, at this exact moment. The gray dress, and the letters, and the Latin, and the 3 pages, and the 2 coffee cups, and the man who had said no ma'am, and the door that had turned out to be a door. She thought about her father, who had believed her mind was worth every language the world had locked away from her. She thought about what it means to be seen fully, completely, without the requirement that you make yourself smaller first. She set her Blackstone on the desk. She looked at the 17 faces. She said, "Good morning. My name is Abigail Mercer. I am going to teach you everything I know, and I'm going to tell you something first before we begin that I need you to hear and remember and carry with you for the rest of your lives." The room was completely still. Even Ruth was still. "Your mind," Abigail said, "belongs to you, not to your father, not to your husband, not to the county, not to anyone who has ever looked at you and decided in advance what you were worth. It is yours. It was always yours. And there is no document forged or otherwise that can take it from you." She let that sit in the room for a moment. Then she opened the Blackstone. "Now," she said, "let us begin." And that is how it ended, and how it began. Not with a fairy tale, not with a rescue, not with a woman made whole by a man's attention, or diminished by a world's indifference. It ended with a deed in a woman's name, and a room full of girls who had been told no, and a man who had learned at 35 the difference between intelligence and courage. It ended with a school on 2 acres of Virginia land in the summer of 1816, built on 8 months of invisible work and 3 pages of careful truth and the unshakable conviction of a woman who had decided somewhere between the gray dress and the Latin and the long walk down the east corridor that she was done making herself small enough for the world to feel comfortable. Some people are hidden, not because their minds are small,
but because the world has spent considerable effort convincing them to agree that they are. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes in courtrooms and libraries and servants' sitting rooms and candle-lit parlors, where powerful men speak in languages they assume you cannot understand. Sometimes the greatest act of courage is simply to answer, in every language you know, at full volume, without apology. Abigail Mercer answered, and the room and the county and the life she built from nothing on the far side of that answer were never the same again.